Craig Packer is a biologist and the former director of the Serengeti Lion Project. His work has appeared numerous times in National Geographic, and he's the author of the book Lions in the Balance. This is Craig Packer. I'm Duncan Gammey. You're listening to Duck Tank. All right. I'm here with Craig Packer. Craig, thank you for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
Some of the people I've talked to for this podcast have such unusual and unique jobs that, like, the first thing I want to know is, like, how did they get started doing what they do? And in your case, I came to know about you through your research on lions. And I'm vaguely familiar with the story, but can you tell me, like, what exactly, how did you get involved in that?
Well, so I was very, I don't know, I was sort of wandering through the late 60s.
Nice.
I had an opportunity in 1972 to spend my semester abroad in Africa when I was an undergraduate. And at the time, I was a pre-med student, and I was thinking I was going to be going to medical school. But this opportunity came up so that I could go to Africa. And it was to work with somebody that I barely even knew about. Her name is Jane Goodall. And So when they said, anybody want to go and, you know, go to Tanzania and work with Dr. Goodall. And she has this long-term study looking at chimpanzees, and they do all this amazing stuff. And then there are other opportunities there besides doing the stuff with the chimps. And so I reckoned that, that'd be pretty cool. I'd like to go to Africa because I really wanted to see a zebra.
That's what compelled you.
Really cool, you know.
Was Jane Goodall at this point, was she renowned internationally, or was she just like another scientist?
She was pretty well renowned already. She had appeared in a number of National Geographic TV shows, and the magazine was a big thing in those days, and she'd been featured in a number of stories. Anyway, so I was kind of strategic because my primary goal was to go over there and eventually see a zebra, not specifically to work with Jane Goodall on chimpanzees. So I said, so what else have they got going over there? And so they were also trying to develop a parallel program at Gombe on baboons, which are these large monkeys that are not nearly as interesting to people who obsess over early man. The idea has been for many years that if you look at our closest relatives, you might learn something about the origins of human behavior, and chimps are our closest relatives. But I thought, well, you know, if I'm going to go see a zebra, there'd be a lot of people wanting to do that. So I said, what else is there? And they said, well, there's this baboon project. So I said, okay. Anyway, that's just how I got over there, which is kind of a whim. And then the whole program of getting to Gombe was delayed. There was a lot of problems in getting permits from the Tanzanian government to bring these students over. And so I was at Stanford in time, and Stanford was trying to make sure they're doing everything right in terms of getting anything with the permits. And so by the time I went over, I was not thinking. And at the end of the time I was supposed to be there, that overlapped with when I should have gone off to medical school. Mm. So I was like, oh, I forgot to go to medical school.
Right. As one does, and, yes.
And then, so I wrote to the medical school and I said, can I come late? And they said, no. And I said, oh, okay. So I then decided to stay on extra at Gombe. And by then, I actually got into the whole thing of studying animal behavior. I thought it was really interesting.
So at this – sorry to interrupt. At this point, you were already – because when you say, like, you're willing to delay or actually forego medical school, you were already, like, into, like, okay, I want to see where this goes. It wasn't just, like, a whim, like, oh, I'm going to go to Africa for a semester.
Well, it was kind of a whim, and being kind of so switched off that I didn't pay attention to the calendar or anything. Mm. But I was really absorbed in the work, and I just found that watching these monkeys doing fairly complicated things. It's like, oh my God, you know, these wild animals have very intricate and interesting lives. And so they have family dynamics, they have rivalries, they have friends, and they do a lot of really complicated things. And so when I failed to get to medical school, there were a number of graduate students who were at Gombe at the same time. And they said, oh, you should go to graduate school. And so I said, okay. So I ended up doing my graduate degree, my PhD, on baboons, on their behavior. And because in those days, there were no American universities that had such well-developed programs in animal behavior, I ended up going to England. And so I did my PhD at the University of Sussex. And then after that, I just was so upset because it was really fun. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was intellectually very stimulating to, you know, why is it the animals behave this way? Because, you know, we all grow up with cats and dogs, right? And what right. they do, we kind of assume it's because, you know, we're feeding them and they've got, you know, an interest in whatever it is their master wants. Well, for dogs, maybe not so much with cats. But you watch these wild animals and it's like, whoa, they've got their own motivations. They've got their own priorities and what dictates what they're going to do when. And so I got really caught up in with the baboons. They turned out to be quite cooperative animals. And so there were certain situations where the baboons are just sort of these monkeys wandering around in the forest would suddenly team up and act in unison to do something. And so this little bit of cooperation is a really important question in evolutionary biology because, you know, we're all used to the idea of nature red in tooth and claw, and it's every man for himself. But there are circumstances where some animals are really cooperative, like ants, you know, and social insects and stuff. But in mammals, it's really, really rare to see that kind of cooperation. And I was seeing it in the baboons. And a couple of years after that, I was still doing other work on primates, and the opportunity came up to get involved with the Serengeti Lion Project. And lions, wow. And I did, you know, during those first year or so in Africa, I did actually get to see my zebra. And I did actually see lions. And, you know, my impression of lions was, oh my God, they sleep all the time and they're incredibly boring moment to moment. And whereas the baboons, you know, they're monkeys, they're monkeying around with things, they're always doing something. So if you're trying to watch and get a sense of what makes them tick, you've got something to see. With lions, it's like, oh, you got to wait till they wake up, which is usually at night, and they're going to, you know, stick to the tall grass, you might not get a good idea. But at any rate, the opportunity came up to go back to Africa again and study lions in the Serengeti. And the cool thing at that point was that this was in 1978, that the lions had already been studied for about a dozen years. And in any population of wild animals, if you go out and you just see all these animals, it's just a mishmash. But what happens if you get to know them as individuals is that, oh, right, the reason she's so pissed off at that other monkey is because, you know, they're from different families or, you know, it's her older sister and she's just fed up with her, whatever. All that stuff that happens, you know, in any family helps you get the background. And so with the lions, 12 years was actually three whole generations. And so in going to Africa to see the lions, it's like, whoa, okay, not only do we know how sisters are with each other and brothers, but also, you know, grandmothers. And so many questions that we ask in biology when it comes to behavior really depends on how closely related any two individuals are. So that, you know, we all know that we're supposed to look after our own children, right?
Sure.
Because that's how our genes get into the next generation. But we should also be pretty nice to our nephews and nieces, and even to our cousins. You know, if there's the right situation, then it might be a good thing evolutionarily to bias our behavior towards, you know, not even the closest, but some of our somewhat close relatives. And so all that was known in the lions. And so I thought, okay, that's a really cool thing. So that's what brought me out there initially, was the interest in the intricacies of the behavior. And lions are so ridiculously intricate in their behavior because they hunt together and they raise their babies together. And you have a pride of females. You have a coalition of males. The coalition of males comes into a pride from somewhere else. All the babies are born at about the same time. The mothers pull them together in a creche, we call it, you know, a babysitting group. And they do all these things together. I mean, they'll nurse each other's young.
Are lions monogamous?
No. So lions have a very complicated social system. So what's cool about lions, they're the only social cat. And their social system is really unique amongst animals. So instead of there just being a female by herself, which is the typical cat system, and a male that has a territory that overlaps the territory of three or four different females, you have groups of females that we call prides, and there can be up to 20 females in the same pride. And this is also what we call a fission-fusion society. So they're not all 20 together at the same time in the same place, like a troop of monkeys.
Right.
It's much more spread out. And so you see a couple of three females together, and then the next day they're associating with somebody else, but they're only within that network of the pride. And so all the females within the pride are able to breed, and they all have babies at about the same rate as each other, which is also really unusual. In most carnivores that are social, like dogs, spotted hyenas, and there's a couple of mongooses, meerkats and things, usually it's just one female, like the alpha female, they call them the wolves. And they're the ones that do all the breeding. And there's an alpha male. But in the lions, there's no hierarchy. So you have this egalitarian society. It's almost unique in nature. And that's one of the things that's really appealing. You know, we like to think at our own society, how could it be more egalitarian? It's not, but compared to a lot of other species, we are. And so lions are truly a paragon in many ways in the way they organize themselves.
You were saying, okay, so a couple of things that are going through my mind as you're saying that, that I want to touch on. One, when you said you were doing some wandering in the 60s, I was curious if that at all led to your identification with these communal living, non-hierarchical lions.
Not so much.
No. Okay.
No. It's actually interesting. Most of those kinds of, I was not involved in any of those kinds of communes. I was certainly indignant about government malfeasance.
Right.
And, you know, I wonder where are the protests today, but so for sure that, but otherwise, you know, the egalitarianism in humans seems to be our ancestral condition. If you look at bands of hunter-gatherer societies, so like they used to be called the Bushmen, now they're called the San, the Khoisan that live in the deserts of Kalahari, and there's some hunter-gatherers in the Amazon as well. Those societies are very egalitarian. And it's only, it seems, the result of human societies evolving from these simple hunter-gatherer bands to larger societies, particularly where there's agriculture. And once you have agriculture, then there's real value in having land, handing it on to your children. And that has tended to lead to much more despotic social systems. So the origins of pharaohs and shahs and kings and emperors and all that sort of stuff happened after we became much more sedentary and we were much more able to monopolize resources at the expense of our own kind.
Yeah.
So that sort of is how that's evolved. And you know, that wasn't what appealed to me in the beginning. I just happened to have come from that era. I think it's more that, you know, during those times, you didn't worry so much because, you know, it was the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, very vibrant economy, and I don't think people worried so much about, you know, making sure you can have a job once you get out of college. Mm-hmm. And so I think I was reasonably relaxed about giving up going to medical school and instead venturing off, you know, doing a graduate degree in animal behavior.
Yeah, and that really sucks that that's not the case so much anymore, because it's, you know, the amount of like dynamism in young people has definitely got to be reduced. If it's like, oh my God, I have $200,000 in student debt, you know, I'd love to get into social services or something like that, but I have to get a higher paying job.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then the other thing that was going through my head was when you said that cooperative behavior is not as prevalent in mammals, as opposed to like insects, which are like much dumber creatures. Mm-hmm. So why is that? Is it?
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting question. So the social insects, they're not egalitarian. I mean, they're the exact opposite. They're about as despotic as you can get, because there's a queen. Oh, yeah. She's doing all the reproductions. I mean, she's literally the ovaries for the entire colony. And so it's very despotic. But what has happened in those situations is that there may be certain circumstances in the environment. So imagine it's a very patchy environment, and there's some places where you can thrive. And if you don't have access to that very rich area, you're not going to do so well. And so in ants and bees and things, if you have certain circumstances where you can gain access to these very rich areas, and then you can manage to get the reproduction as you as an individual, and you have all your daughters doing all the work for you, it's very common in social insects, because they have a very weird genetic system that is really weird. So male bees, the drones, they're the result of virgin birth. So an egg that is not fertilized remains in the haploid state, but it grows up and it becomes a male. Whereas daughters are the result of sexual reproduction. So the mother mates with one of these drones, and so her haploid egg is restored to the diploid state, okay? So her daughters, weirdly enough, through that genetic system, it's very complicated to explain, but they're actually more related to their sisters than they would be to their own offspring. And so in terms of getting your genetics into the next generation, there's a bias there in that female bees, female ants can say, oh, I'm a worker. Well, that's not so bad. Because right. I can help my mom to produce a lot more sisters, and then I'm getting a lot more genes out there. So it's a combination of kind of environmental circumstances that force them to work together. Then they have this weird genetic system where, well, one of the best ways to do that is to help mom produce more sisters. So mammals, we don't have virgin birth, at least not on a regular basis.
Yeah.
and so there's not that bias for females to want to have more sisters rather than more offspring of their own. So that's one thing for this eusociality. Another, because we're so smart, and because we can do so many things, there are just a lot of circumstances where individuals can just get away with being more selfish, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there's some circumstances. So like with the monkeys, they don't cooperate that much, but they're kind of forced to live in these groups, again, because of the patchy environment. And it's enough to be in that group sharing those resources. They can still be kind of bitchy with each other about it.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about the lions is that they come back to that situation again, where it's kind of a patchy environment, and they have to defend like the water hole or the series of water holes that are close together as a group to be able to monopolize whatever prey might wander into that area. And so they have then an incentive to be cooperative that just happens to be much higher than most other species. And because they're so dangerous, that no one female is going to end up being able to sort of cow her sisters into being subordinate. So they're all going to end up, they end up in a kind of a situation of mutually assured destruction. It's so costly to fight over, you're telling me I can't have babies? And they'll fight back, right?
Yeah.
So they've got this kind of, it's an interesting kind of situation. They're kind of nuclear partners, but because you've got these groups cooperating against other groups, it forges this very strong sisterhood.
Interesting. That's when you were talking about the fact that the more intelligent creatures can get away with being more selfish. I was talking to Chomsky about that, and he was saying that it's possible that intelligence in many ways is an almost lethal mutation, where you look at the more successful species, it tends to be like insects, and only recently were humans, you know, skyrocketing in terms of their population. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the thing that there have been so many things over the years. I mean, I can remember when I first went to Gombe and working with Jane, you know, she had dispelled one of the definitions of humanity in that for the longest time, scientists felt you could distinguish humans from other species because we were the only animal to use tools. And so, you know, one of our ancestral species, Homo habilis, means handyman. And so it's a member of our own genus, Homo. And the thought was, you know, habilis, oh yeah, first tool users, right? Well, when Jane was there back in the early 60s, she saw chimps using tools. It's like, oh. Now, since her first observation, a lot of animals have been seen to use tools, but you know, she was the head of the curve there and saying, no, humans are not unique on that. So through time, what we've seen is more and more things like that, humans are unique because, you know, no, if you look harder, other animals do the same thing. And so through time, what I think I'm left with anyway, is the sense of how do we view the future? And humans don't discount the future as much as most animals do. And what I mean by that is that most selfish actions, and we're capable of being real assholes, no doubt about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when we're being an asshole, we're generally discounting the future. We're so caught up in the moment that we forget how bad that's going to look or what kind of consequences it might have in the future. And most of the time with most animals, they're in that eternal now. There's something, I want it, I grab it right now.
Yeah.
And a lot of experiments on animals show that they really don't think that far into the future, okay? And you know about the marshmallow test, right? You know, the marshmallow test is you've got a waiting room and you know, it's actually an experiment. You tell some kid, okay, you're gonna see so-and-so, you wait here. Oh, but by the way, if you know, there's a bowl of marshmallows, right? On the table in front of the kids. So if you can hold off on getting into the marshmallows so long, we'll give you a prize of some sort, okay? Or you get more marshmallows, or however it works. And so, you know, study after study shows that there's some kids who just can't do it. They're so impulsive, right? And they just can't get that if they would wait, you know, 3 minutes, 30 seconds, whatever it is, right, they would get a bigger reward. So they're impulsive. So that impulsivity, as we see in humans, varies from individual to individual. But if you compare it to animals, no animal could pass the marshmallow test.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're all in the eternal now. And so what I think about with humans, getting back to the gist of your question, which is, you know, do we have a future? As bad as we seem to be, and a lot of that's playing out right now. I mean, I'm working at home. You're working at home.
Right.
We've got public health people who are really wanting us to hold off, right? And then we also have people who impulsively want us to get back to work right now because the economy's collapsing. And people have got their own motivation about where they're going to be on that spectrum between, you know, the public good and the private good, right? I mean, some people are harmed much worse by the loss of jobs, obviously, depending on what your employment is. And so people are in different situations. But if you had us as animals, everybody would be out there. There'd be no point.
Yeah.
There, right?
Yeah.
Forget about it. All now. So the fact that we can do this as much as we have, and, you know, the virus doesn't lie. The virus, you know, as a lot of people have said, we have to find out what the virus says. And the virus is showing us that all around the planet, most people have modified their behavior so that the rate of infection really has diminished over what it could have been if we'd carried on business as usual.
Right.
So I think that's a tremendous, you know, that's a great advertisement for the human race. And,
yeah,
you know, as a lot of people have said, things are going to get a lot worse with climate change. And there are going to be more crises. And unless we, you know, unless we learn from this pandemic and we have more tools, like we stockpile testing kits, we stockpile swabs, or whatever it is we're going to need for the next one, you know, if we do that, it might not be so bad. And even with climate change, even if they become more frequent, we'll also have the fact that, you know, some of the vaccines that are in development may not be so specific to coronavirus. Some of the treatments may not be unique to one virus, but they might be broad spectrum, kind of like antibiotics are. And so I think human behavior shows a responsiveness that we shouldn't despair over, despite what we see on the cable news with extreme behavior and technology. And we're seeing a lot of cooperation and collaboration between different labs that's really quite unprecedented. A lot of people are viewing what a year ago in terms of virological studies would have been the private good of, oh, I've got a new treatment, I'm going to get rich off of it.
Right.
More of a sense of, well, this is a public good, right? Maybe we all need to be able to do this, right? And so there are these things that I think should actually give us hope that our species is going to persist far longer than people think. And I don't think that any other species would be able to do that. I think any other species would just be subject to periodic outbreaks. They just, obviously, you know, they don't have the technology, obviously, but they also don't have the lack of impulsiveness, the willingness to quarantine themselves.
Well, I hope you're right. The only thing that that kind of sticks for me there is that the lack of the ability to be in that eternal now, which is very much something like a Buddhist monk would say we should strive for. That same inability to be in the now is also what has created in many ways the means of our destruction. I mean, when you were talking about creating agriculture earlier when we were talking and how that, you know, sort of laid the foundation for a lot of despotic societies. Okay, well, you can't plant grain unless you're willing to delay gratification. So I don't know. I mean, I get what you're saying, but on the one hand, you know, no other animal would create a problem like climate change on their own, right?
Well, you know, that's another question. So, given what we've done to the environment, let's go back to Africa and let's go back to animals.
Yes.
What we've done to the environment, there are a lot of people who would say that there are some species that are exploiting the limited space that is left for them to the extent that, oh, we need to do something about it. And the classic example of that is the elephant, the African elephant.
Yes, I've heard about this.
So until the poaching crisis in the late 1970s in East Africa, there were a lot of people, and they actually did cull elephants in Kenya because the elephants being confined now to these national parks, which is just a fraction of their original range, they're now crowding together in smaller areas, knocking down all the trees. And when a drought came along, boom, they're in real bad trouble. Okay. Later on, then people stopped saying we should cull elephants because the poachers were, you know, getting rid of the problem for the conservationists, so they didn't say it anymore. Outside of South Africa. South Africa, they kept saying the same thing. Oh, we got too many elephants, because they didn't have a poaching crisis. The elephants are knocking down all the trees. We should cull them. And so there's a lot of debate as to whether the situation was as bad as the wildlife managers claimed in either East Africa or South Africa to truly justify the culling. But I think at least in some cases, yeah, they do knock down all the trees. And so they are going to they're going to strip their environment of the necessary resources. And we've certainly seen that in other cases. There's a famous study of caribou in a small island of Alaska, where they were introduced to this island, and life was great for the caribou to begin with, because there's all this lichen and they're chomping away and they're having babies, and they just outstripped everything. And lichen's very slow growing. So that was a cumulative resource that they basically overconsume, and then they all starved to death. So the population crashed. So animals do that. And so that's called density dependent population regulation. And you can have circumstances where you hopefully going to reach kind of what's called a carrying capacity and things stay fairly stable there. But there are known cases where species have overshot and then crashed.
Right.
And so we're looking like we're doing that in a way that is so hard for most people to appreciate and conflicts with the way a lot of very influential people earn their livelihood.
Oh yeah.
Back to the inequalities.
No. Of course, it's interesting that you say that, because I was talking to this other ecologist the other day, and he was very much of the opinion that when humans developed agriculture, that was the first major tragic mistake of our species, and that he was almost. It was a good conversation, but he was almost kind of putting down humans, like we're these miserable pieces of shit, and all these other animals are basically still living in the Garden of Eden, you know, innocent and but you clearly don't feel that way.
Well, you would not want to live the life of an animal. I mean, most animals have 50-60% infant mortality. Is that what we want? You know,
right?
I mean, we've crossed so many new expectations now. I mean, look at the extraordinary medical interventions that we make, you know, for people who can afford it. You know, every wanted fetus should reach the age of 100, you know, and that's crazy in terms of history. Doesn't make it ethically wrong, but it's just so totally different for anybody who wants to live like animals, you know. The chance, I mean, what, there's 7.8 billion people on Earth? How many millions would there be? You know, the human population for agriculture was only, I think, in the 100 millions. So 90% of us wouldn't even be here to have this discussion. You know,
yeah.
We're only here because of agriculture. And the fact is that agriculture is not as evil as people want to make either. So I'm happen to be working with some economists right now and some other ecologists, and we're looking at what's happening to the Earth's land. We're very interested in how much land is left to support the remaining biodiversity. And we know that forests are being cleared in some countries for agriculture or for even for ranching, right? And what we see in our data, if you look at the whole world, that's true. We're still clearing forests. We're still clearing land so that we can feed all of us with our agriculture, and also that we can feed our cattle, because more and more people want to eat meat. And, you know, that's a conflict with what's left in nature as well. There's also many places where we're using agriculture to feed our cars. So Iowa and places, a lot of the ethanol is for transportation. So all these things are going on, but if you look across the planet, what is happening is that to meet this growing demand for resources, there's two strategies. And we divide these strategies into those involved in extensification. So you have more extensive agriculture, you have more land using the same techniques, or you rely on intensification. And intensification means of the land you've already set aside for agriculture, what is your yield? How many bushels of wheat? How many, you know, whatever? How many kilos of cocoa? Whatever you're growing off the land.
Sure.
What you see is in the wealthier countries, it's intensification. So the yields have gone up, okay? And if you divide the world according to its wealth, what we see is that's true with the richest countries. And you go in each tier down, because the World Bank, you know, classifies a country as, you know, the wealthiest, upper middle, lower middle, et cetera, all the way down to the lowest. And all of those tiers of economic classification are showing rapid improvement in yields to meet the needs. It's only in the lowest of the low in terms of their economic classification. The poorest countries, they're still relying on extensification. So where we're seeing rainforests being chopped down in Democratic Republic of Congo or Gabon and some of these other countries in Africa, these are very, very poor countries. And so that leaves us with the challenge then of, well, hey, wait a minute. What we're seeing is you can get much more bang per buck through intensification. And you can even do this with less fertilizer. You can do it with less of the pollutants that used to be such a huge problem. Now, there's still too much nitrogen deposition. There's still too much reliance on these kinds of inputs. But if they're done appropriately, you can actually improve the efficiencies. So, long way of saying, it depends on where you're talking about. And is it hopeless? And we don't think so. We think there's still time. Hopefully, you know, things are going to be set back right now because of the pandemic. But hopefully when the world economy gets humming again in a couple of years, there are lessons that could be hopefully applied to some of the poorer countries so that they too can switch over from extensification, chopping everything down, to intensification, getting more yield off the land you've already set aside. And what we know from the U.S., just to put this in perspective, is that if you go back to the 1800s, there's now much less land in the U.S. under the plow than there used to be. Because Iowa is so incredibly efficient, you know, a lot of land, especially in the eastern states, that's not profitable to grow crops on anymore. So you have your hippie communes, or you have your small colleges, or whatever else,
right,
can use that land, and you can actually reforest it. There's been a lot of reforestations in the U.S. And so those trends, we hope, will happen all over the world. And so it really isn't too late.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that at least one smart person can be hopeful on this podcast. Everyone else has been doom and gloom. So thank you. when you're talking about the amount of wildlife preserves being shrunk over time, there's kind of this like romantic yearning for just open wildlife. And I remember I was on like a boat when I was in like eighth grade, and we were out to sea, and we looked around and it was just all ocean. And it was a really beautiful moment, because it was like, wow, there's no humans here. But you go anywhere on land and you're not going to get that. In terms of lions, what is their situation in terms of like their conservation status? Where are they able to go? Are they all basically just in national parks now, or what's the status there?
So essentially, they are in landscapes that have been set aside either as a national park or some sort of game reserve. These different kinds of protected areas have different names, different labels. and different kinds of protective status. So in a national park in Africa, it's pretty much like a national park here. You can't go and, you know, build a house or, you know, make a farm. So that's the highest protective status. There are a lot of other areas in Africa that are kind of in the middle somewhere where the wildlife is meant to be protected, but people may live, provided they engage maybe in only limited activities. So in a lot of drier parts of Africa, people earn their livelihood through pastoralism, meaning they live on livestock, either cattle or increasingly because of climate change, more on goats. So that the land there is too dry to grow crops. So the only way you're going to get food out of the land is to have a grazer eat it, eat the grass, and then you can harvest the meat. And so in those areas, there are still lions. So in the parks themselves, there's issues, and this is going to be, I may not be quite so optimistic about lions as a species here.
Yeah.
In many of those national parks, they are immediately adjoining agricultural areas. And so there's enough rainfall that people can be growing maize or cotton, and maize is what everybody in the world calls corn outside of the U.S. So they're either growing a food crop or some other crop. And the wildlife may be attracted to those fields. And so there's huge conflict. And so there's more and more of a need to have physical barriers between the parks and the people in those agricultural areas. Because there's really nothing for the wildlife to do out there except get in trouble, eating people's crops. I mean, an elephant can go out and wreck a whole family's livelihood for a year just in one night.
Yeah.
So that's really problematic. But if you go on the drier side, they can't grow crops. And instead, they're relying on pastoralism and livestock. And in those situations, you still have problems with lions, because lions, again, they may produce more offspring than can possibly survive in an area. And so rather than starving to death because there's no wildebeest for me because all the other lions are eating wildebeest here, what's that over there? When they leave the park and there's a cow. And that was easy. That was really easy. And they do it again. And so then that's really hitting into people's livelihoods. And these pastoralist communities tend to be very, very poor. It's not the best option. And if it's you and me, I'd much rather, you know, have 40 acres on one side where I could grow a crop than, you know, hoping that my goats are going to give enough food for me and my family. I mean, it's really risky, especially drier weather and everything. So those are the people that can least afford to have this perturbation, this disruption to their livelihood. And so, of course, they retaliate. And so they may spear the lions, depending on, you know, if they're Maasai, who still do that sort of thing with spears. More commonly now, we see people using poison. That's very common throughout Africa. The lions have killed a goat or a cow and is not at the carcass at the moment. It's hiding in the bushes during the daytime. So people go out, just lace the carcass with poison, wait for the lion to come back, boom. So that's...
Do really people eat lions?
No, they don't eat lions. I'll get to that in a second, but let me just finish on this.
Sure, yeah.
That's the problem, and what is the solution? And so there are a number of projects that have started out in the last 7 or 10 years to work with local people. So conservationists are going out working with these pastoralist people and helping them do a better job at protecting their livestock against the lions. So that if they don't lose the cow in the first place, then there's no reason to retaliate. And so there are some success stories on that, at least so far, that people have been able to improve the husbandry practices to the extent that the local pastoralists are saying, okay, lions are cool. And the lions are bringing enough tourist revenue because tourists would come to see the lions either in the national park itself or even in their own areas. That provides jobs. So that provides an incentive for people to live with lions. So that's the positive side of that. except for the pandemic. So everything shut down, and who knows how long it's going to be shut down for. This could go on for years as a major impact on the national parks, on the conservancies that are involved local people in the management of wildlife in these pastless areas. And that's we're just going to have to see how that plays out. My latest communications with folks I know who work in those areas is it's bad right now because there's just there's no tourist revenue. And so those people who were being employed now don't have jobs. So there's going to have to be an alternative. Then you mentioned, do people eat lions? No, they don't directly. But there is this weird thing that's happened in the last dozen years or so. In China and Asia, so Vietnam, Laos, China, there are traditional medicines. So in the same way that we saw with the wet market in Wuhan, that there were weird wildlife species like pangolins, some of those are there as food, sometimes they're there as medicine. And one of the weirder medicines is tiger bone wine. And tiger bone wine is supposed to have various medicinal properties. And so that's been a source of some of the poaching in Asia of tigers for their bones. Well, there are very few tigers in Asia left. There's been more protections looking after the few remaining tigers. Meanwhile, in South Africa, there's been this very weird thing down there where people who have ranch land, instead of raising cattle or goats, they're raising wildlife. And one of the species they've been more or less farming there is the lion. And the lions there can be shot by mostly Americans, tourist hunters, in a kind of a thing called canned hunting.
Right.
And the canned hunting sorry, my coffee delivery system just arrived. Thank you, coffee delivery system.
No worries.
So canned hunting is where mostly Americans and some Europeans would pay $20,000 to go to South Africa to shoot a lion that had been raised on one of these lion farms.
Okay? Right.
And so there has been less of a demand for canned hunting because the U.S. government during the Obama administration banned the importation of trophy lions from these canned facilities. So here are these guys with all these lions. They're feeding them, you know, horses and cows that were going to be killed anyway at an abattoir, but they're still expensive. And so they're trying to make a buck because that's the business, right?
Right.
So one of the things they said was, hey, China, Vietnam, Laos, how about lion bone wine?
Oh, wow. So they just made it up.
All these bones.
Yeah.
And so for the last few years, they've been exporting thousands of lion skeletons to Asia. And so you can get, I think in some cases, it's still called tiger bone, but when you read the ingredients, it says, you know, made with lion bones, even though it's called tiger bone wine. And so anyway, that has now created demand for lion bones that did not exist 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago, and now it's there. And when this first happened, a lot of us were hoping that the demand would be met entirely by these captive lions, and that would leave the wild lions alone. But in the last couple of years, there's growing evidence now that, well, hey, you know, we don't want any lions around here because they're eating our cows, they're a pain in the ass, and we can sell their bones. So now we got another incentive to kill the lions.
Wow. Yeah, that's it's weird that the rarest animals seem to have like the most purchase as an exotic medicine. You know, like lions or bald eagles. Like no one's taken pigeon bone broth, I suppose.
No, but I think they're also trying. I think they're also trying to get the reflected glory. I mean, you know, I will be as mighty as a pigeon. you know.
Yeah.
I have the talons of a pigeon. Where's yeah. the popcorn?
I see. Yeah, trying to imbibe the spirit. Wow.
Yeah.
That's okay, so lions are not their population is a little shaky. Oh, one of the things I wanted to ask you is you had gone into I'm probably going to pronounce the name wrong, but like the Chauvet
yes.
caves. Chauvet,
yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? That was so, I mean,
yeah.
People very rarely go in there.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. As it happened, so I was first approached by the French Culture Ministry to look at some photographs of these new cave paintings that were discovered whenever it was, about 20 odd years ago, 20 or 30 years ago. And they asked me what I thought of them. And I thought, wow, these are amazing. Because they were so lifelike. And they just popped to me because I'd seen African lions showing some of the same behaviors that the French artists had painted 36,000 years ago. And that was, technically it's a different species. It's called Panthera spelea or Atrox. There's different names, but it's the cave lion, but definitely a lion. And so I saw these pictures and it just like, wow, this is incredible. And so,
what you said they were depicting the behavior of the lions. What do you mean?
Yeah. So, there was a pair of lions walking in tandem. So two lions walking side by side and, basically, you know, it's like they're in profile. And so you could see one slightly behind the other.
Yeah.
And the French themselves, mostly being artists, were thinking that that was just kind of a funny extra outline. And I said, no, that's a male and a female. Because the one that's behind with the larger outline has slightly different dimensions, but it also has a scrotum. You can see its testicles. And the one in the front does not have a scrotum, does not have testicles. That's a male and a female. And they said, oh, okay, cool. And we had seen that same behavior. And if you're lucky, I mean, you might see that same behavior in African lions, that if a female is in heat, if she's receptive, that one of the males in the pride will try to monopolize her through her estrus period. And if she starts to move somewhere, he'll actually walk right side by side, shoulder to shoulder. And he's kind of trying to veer her off in one direction so that she doesn't go off to another male. And that's what this showing in that cave painting is like, wow. And there were other things like that. And so we just got into a conversation. And then a few years after that, I was invited just fortuitously to a conference in Paris. And I was still in communication with them. And I said, oh, I'm going to be coming over. Said, oh, would you like to see the cave? And I said, yeah. And so we went from Paris down to the Ardèche Valley. And it was a big thing going in. I mean, you know, I was there on honeymoon and I was hoping my wife could go with me. But they wouldn't let her in, which was not a good start.
Yeah.
And she delivered the, you know, anyway. So cave to get into it had for the time the ultimate high-tech security. I mean, I'd never seen this anywhere else, but there was one way to get into the cave, and it had this electronic surveillance thing, and there were like palm prints. It was like palm print recognition, and there were like, I don't know, three or four people on Earth whose palm had been fitted on this. So they're the only people that could possibly unlock the door to go in.
Wow.
And the reason for that, well, besides obvious from vandalism, which would be horrific, but there are bad people out there. You know, the human race may be better on average, but we got our bad elements. So.
You mean people who might want to steal the paintings or something like that?
Well, or just going in to face them, you know. People do horrible things.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? That's at the worst case. But even in the best case, where people just go in, there's another cave Lascaux, which is very famous for its cave paintings that are, they're like 12,000 years old, but it's been open to tourism. And so many tourists went in that in our breath, we're breathing in and out. As we know, our breath carries microorganisms. And this contaminated the cave walls. And she started getting these growths of fungus and algae and things that actually, you know, they were destroying the surface of the paintings. So to prevent that from ever happening in Chauvet, they were trying to restrict it to a very, very minimum number of people. And so I was the fifth non-French person allowed into that cave or something. And they'd contacted me because I was, you know, kind of an authority on lions. They'd also contacted an authority on some of the other species. Anyway, I was the lion expert.
Yeah.
And so we went in to see everything, and it was just a profound experience because, I mean, if you've ever been into any cave, you go in and you have to kind of crouch down a little bit, and there's just this silence, you know, and there's just this sort of aura of anything when you see the walls. And, you know, the lighting there again was very restrictive because they didn't want algae starting to grow on the walls or anything. So things were just, you know, he had a lamp and light things up. And I'd say, oh my God. And again, you know, seeing them in person, it just made it much more impressive because you can't tell how big they are from photographs.
Yeah.
And they're really big. And so, you know, they're more or less life size. And so what struck me about these I want to call them photographs. I mean, they're like literally Paleolithic photographs of lion behavior. And they chose certain things to portray. So they had that mating pair. And, you know, that passageway where the mating pair is, it's very narrow. It's very close to you. You look at it from only a few feet away. And so it's this big, impressive, you know, life-size lion drawings. But to go into that very narrow passageway, it's kind of Freudian because at the entrance of that passageway, because, you know, you have any cave and there's kind of broader openings and then narrowings. In that particular narrowing, they're one of the few portrayals of anything human at all is of a woman's vulva. So you're literally like having your Freudian moment, you know, in this birth passage going into this narrow thing. And there's a mating pair of lions on the wall.
Oh my God. Ordinary. That do you think that was intentional? Like all those bits of imagery?
I don't think that was accidental. And, you know, and they didn't show the sex act itself with the lions, but those were lions who would be mating.
Oh my God. So, That's not just people like drawing cartoons on the wall. That's like legitimate aspirations to art, where you're the passageway, like a birth canal. Like that's amazing.
36,000 years ago.
Wow.
You know, it's another 30,000 years before we even have the pyramids. You know?
Yeah.
So it's mind blowing. And so there were other things like that, and you know, and with that one again, that pair was so informative because that would have been an adult male with an adult female. The male did not have a mane. So, you know, it's a very similar species, Panthera atrox or Panthera spelea, depending on your taxonomy. We could see from other pictures that they're showing groups of lions confronting prey. So it looks like they're a social species, just like the modern lion is a social species. But they don't have manes. So we learned a lot of biology just from those photographs. But my favorite of all in there was of two lions. And in this case, it might be between two males, actually, because males do have dominance. Females don't. They're egalitarian. Males are a bit more despotic.
Sweet.
Go figure. But there's two lions, and there's a dominant one who's got this very imposing posture. And another one that's crouching. And the one that's crouching is snarling in a very defensive facial expression. And the one that's the dominant one's got its ears back and making a very kind of assertive kind of approach towards the other. I mean, it's astonishing. Again, it's a photograph of animal behavior from 36,000 years ago. And so what I think blew me away more than, I mean, A, this the technical abilities to get that down, really talented artist, they chose to show was purposeful in some way. And obviously these guys knew as much about lions as I did. And, you know, I sat in the Serengeti for many years. I've had many students out there, and we followed those lions for decades. And, you know, we always watched them through binoculars from a vehicle 36,000 years ago. No glass, no wheel.
Yeah.
You know, so these guys are seeing this in person, and they're close enough to see the ears going back, the snarling faces. It's extraordinary. And so it put into a context for me of what it must have been like living there. They were, this cave, the entrance to the cave is on the side of a cliff. And so I assumed that the artist would have watched the lions from the safety of his perch, or her perch, was probably a man.
Why do you say that?
Well, just because I think in those days, I think the women would have been so bound up because they would have been hunter-gatherers. And I just don't think the women would have had that much spare time to become that kind of artist. And I mean, I could be wrong, but you know, and it'd be great if it was a woman, but I'd be kind of surprised just because I think, you know, in hunter-gatherer societies, the men often just sit around. And you see that in a lot of societies, men just sit around, women do all this work.
Yeah.
And so that's what inspired me to say that. So I will say he, because I think it probably was a man.
Sure.
But he was sitting up there with time in his hands because the women are off actually running everything. But he could safely see what was going on from his perch up there. And he had reason to. The reason for watching the lions is that if they're taking down these whacking great things like woolly rhino and, you know, mastodons or whatever else they had, I mean, they had really big, scary things. Humans, that would have been really hard to do. But if the lions caught something and they feed for a while, then they're pretty easy to chase away. And so hunter-gatherers do that still. If they find the lions, we've done a project recently in Botswana where they're really good at tracking lions in the sand. And I said, how come you guys are so good at tracking the lions? Well, we want to know, you know, if they've caught something. And I said, so you can chase them away and eat it. He said, yeah, of course. It's a way of getting protein. It's a free meal. So 36,000 years ago, my assumption is, and again, this would be a male thing because they do more of the hunting, that he would be one of these men who would be involved with carving off a hunk of meat, bringing it back. So he had a reason. He had a very strong reason to be interested in animal behavior. He had a really strong reason to be interested in lions in particular.
That is, that's an amazing, like, just to imagine that scenario. And the fact that the art was so high quality is like, the one thing that I was wondering when you were saying that is, what, as a biologist, why do you think it is that the men are sitting around and then have these like big bursts of activity and like a hunt or something like that, some like really risky, you know, activity, and the women just have like a steady stream of work? Is there any like evolutionary reason for that? Or because a lot of people would be like, oh, this is just you know, people being forced into these positions and how lucky you are to just sit around and do nothing, right?
Well, I think this comes back to, if you actually watch chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, you know, the babies are totally reliant on their mother's milk, and so the mother has to be in proximity with her baby. And as the baby is weaned, we know from studies of chimps that, you know, the mother may spend quite a lot of time on her own with her offspring. Their offspring are really dependent on their mothers until they might even be 10 years old or so. And so, but they're the ones, they're always with their mothers. And the males are doing things like, you know, patrolling the edge of the territory. They tend to do more of the hunting. Females do hunt some, but they rely for animal protein. Female chimps rely a lot more on termites, speaking of social insects. So they'll actually take twigs, poke them into a termite mound, wait for the soldiers to clamp on, pull it off. And so that's a very steady, constant supply. And that's what their babies need. And so with the males, you know, they don't catch a monkey or a small buck every day. That's more occasional. It's also risky. Sometimes they have to leap through the trees. It can be fairly acrobatic sometimes when they're catching their prey. And if you've got a, you know, if you've got a nursing child, so these things are going to definitely lead to a divergence in childcare and the kinds of activities that each sex is engaged in. And I think, you know, studies of, again, of hunter-gatherers and humans, it's the men that go out, and there's a lot of weird sexual politics involved with, you know, they go back, they come back with something they caught with the meat, which women do they give it to, and all that sort of thing. So that's really well defined.
I see.
In our closest relatives and in the hunter-gatherer societies, that men do the more kind of risky things with the occasional big reward. Females have to make sure to have a steady food supply so that their children can grow up.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It's they say about like money managers, like women are get consistently higher returns than men because men choose to do like really risky things, but like sometimes it pays off big. Okay. So the last thing I wanted to ask you, cause we're a little over an hour here, is, you were banned from Tanzania. Is that still in effect?
Yes. So I, as time went on, I moved away from pure research and thinking about why lions cooperate and got more involved with conservation. And one of the issues that seemed very relevant to lion conservation was sport hunting, trophy hunting, because much more land in Tanzania is set aside as hunting blocks than it is set aside as a national park. And when I started on that, I was assuming that the hunters were doing a good job at protecting lions. They're a very valuable tool for conservation. And so I started working with them in good faith on all that. But as time went on, it became clear that any conservation they might be doing was hardly even secondary. Primarily, it was a financial, it's a business. And we began to realize that there had been serious overconsumption, that lions were being shot out excessively throughout most of that area. We came in with some recommendations to try to minimize the impacts of the trophy hunters, because in the long term, if you're thinking long term and you're not discounting the future, that you know there should be no conflict between business and conservation, because you want to have a steady crop of lions that you can harvest year after year after year after year. But a lot of the things that were going on in Tanzania were acting against the long-term interest and more towards short-term profits. And so people were not really doing what they claimed to be doing. And there was a lot of secrecy. I had been in communication with the American government, with our U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because the American government was thinking about whether the lion should be added to our endangered species list, which would prohibit the importation of lion trophies from various countries in Africa. So I voiced concerns about some of the bad practices that were going on that I happened to know about by trying to do the science and looking at the biology of it. And the email that I thought was confidential was released. Ooh. And got back to the businessmen, who then alerted the Tanzanian government. And there was a lot of collusion between the Tanzanian government and the hunting industry itself. They were kind of business partners with each other. And so they decided I should go. And that was, that all happened like 2013, 2014. So I do not go back. And I don't think, I mean, I did go back in 2015 after I wrote Lines in the Balance to see if I could at least go back as a tourist.
Yeah.
And the answer was, no, I'm not allowed to go back as a tourist. And so I was visiting what was left of the Serengeti Lion Project in 2015. And then I was told to leave within the hour. Fortunately, I had a friend with an airplane who flew me out. And I have not been back since.
Was this around the time of that Cecil the Lion, where that dentist gotten a lot of heat on social media?
Well, you know, it's funny. This happened just before Cecil.
Okay.
And so, ironically, it was Cecil who did more than anything else to get everybody to pay attention. Because I was trying to get U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to do something. And in the end, they did. And they did ban lion imports from Tanzania. And to this day, they are banned. Likewise from Zimbabwe. And I don't actually think that's the right tactic. I think you should have leverage, that if you're going to try to get a country to reform its hunting practices, you should say, okay, here's the carrot, here's the stick, you know, or vice versa.
Yeah.
But at any rate, there has not been a reopening of lion hunting exports to the U.S. from Tanzania. But that's really, the energy for that came from Cecil, because I'd been knocking on the doors in Washington, D.C., trying to get them to pay attention to this, and they didn't really want to know. But when Cecil came out, there was such a hue and cry that they did want to know, and then they did start listening, and it started making a difference. And so I think, again, when it comes to the message that anybody should know, not only is it not too late in terms of agriculture on this planet, it's not too late actually to get people to pay attention. And, you know, again, I'm kind of surprised more people aren't out protesting against all the craziness that's been going on the last couple of years, and particularly around the climate, because, you know, we did that in the 60s, and that did lead to changes in Vietnam. And the original Earth Day was a protest against all the pollution. And that led to the EPA actually having teeth, and it really did clean up the air. And so if people will act, it will make a difference. And in a funny way, Cecil, you know, all that shaming and shunning of a dentist here in Minnesota had some of a similar effect. So yeah. If people will rise up and will speak out and organize, it would make a difference.
I think that's a good note to end it on. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. And I hope you had as much fun as I did.
Yeah, good. Good luck with everything.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you to Craig Packer, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.